I blew it already.
Hi, this is Francine.
This is Francine. My name is Francine. I'm an alcoholic. They put this new technology on my ear. And so okay, thank you. Yeah, there are a lot of you here, actually. A couple. I have to tell you, the largest meeting I've ever spoken in front of was at Gopher State in 1993. And there were 6,000 people. And I had actually taken my mother with me to that conference. And I don't know if I was more afraid of speaking in front of 6,000 people or speaking in front of my mother. But we got through it. So thank you so much. I want to thank the committee and particularly Jim for this wonderful, wonderful opportunity to be of service. And I have to tell you, it is. And you know what is scary as it is standing right here? It is awesome. As I get to look out at you and even just hear you say, Francine, and I did say, I'm an alcoholic, right? Right. Just hearing that come back, it's like, oh my God. I am in the presence of my family. And it is so amazing. Yeah, it is. A number of years ago, I heard a woman speak at a conference, and she said, I am brought to you by Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know what? That always stuck with me. And as I've gotten sober over the years, and as my life has so drastically and dramatically changed, I get to stand up here before you this afternoon and tell you that I am brought to you by Alcoholics Anonymous. Who I am, what I feel, how I act, what I do. It's all about what I learned from you almost 26 years ago. And for that, I am so very, very grateful. You know, today, and I want to thank my host. Where is she? Oh, she's right in front of me, way too hard. Right in front of my face. My host, Lynn, for taking me around this morning. We had a delicious experience. We went to the Gate Lodge, and we went to Akron Intergroup. And I have to tell you, in my sobriety, I've had several pivotal moments, personally and as well as with Alcoholics Anonymous, just generally. And I want to share with you a couple of the moments in AA, because today was one of those moments. The first epiphany, if you will, as Barbara talked about last night, which is really nothing more than a spiritual experience, if you're new and don't get that word. It's just a spiritual experience. It's an aha moment. And the first aha moment for me when I got sober was when I was 11 months and 1 week, I went to my first international AA convention in New Orleans. And I have to tell you, was anyone there? Few of you. If you can imagine holding hands with 26,000 recovering alcoholics, it was so absolutely unbelievable. That was the first thing that really made me realize that I was a part of an organization that was bigger than me. The next epiphany, if you will, that really clinched it for me with sobriety was about a year later. My sponsor, which you'll hear a little bit more about her later, and this gives you an idea of who she is, she gave me as a gift to read AA Comes of Age. And I have to tell you, it was a hard book to crack because I came in a high school dropout. I was not educated. I wasn't interested in education. I didn't care about those big words. But she gave me this book, and it took me a lot to get through the book because it was really hard for someone like me. But I have to tell you, when I got through it for like the third time, the essence of AA Comes of Age really let me know once again that I was a part of something so sweet and so delicious that I would never be able to really pin it down. As a result of those two experiences, I have kept coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous day in and day out and year in and year out. And this morning when Lynn and I went to the intergroup, I had that same experience. The same experience as I was looking around the walls at different pieces of our history. And if you've never been there, I really encourage you to go because, boy, it really brings it all home why we are here. Because, you know, I know for me, and perhaps some of you can relate to this, there have been times when I've lost sight, even in Alcoholics Anonymous. There have been times when I thought I've had all the answers. There have been times when I've wanted to leave AA. There have been times when I thought I was just a little too big for my britches. And you know what? I didn't need you guys. I didn't want to hear what you said. You bored me. But I kept coming back. And today, as I was looking at one picture after another on those walls and intergroup, I'm reminded of why I get to stand before you this afternoon. So I feel really, really, really blessed. And if you hear nothing else from me over the next 45 minutes or so, my hope is that you really get how much I love this program, how much I absolutely love it. And let me forewarn you, if you've never heard me speak, if you have a problem with middle-aged women who cannot control their emotions, you might want to leave right about now. Took me 52 years and 26 years of sobriety to learn how to cry, and I never apologize for it, ever, because it truly is a gift that I get to have those feelings today. Anyway, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous if you're newly sober, and I just say that you are in for the most amazing, amazing experience of your lives. And if you're newly sober, you're probably sitting back in your chair right now, maybe because your sponsor dragged you to this meeting. You know, oh, there must be a few of you. Your hands are probably shaking and your palms are sweating and you're saying, yeah, right. It's easy for you to say it's so cool to be here. It's easy for you as you stand up there with all that sobriety to say it's the best thing since sliced bread. And all I can say is it wasn't always that way for me, but it is today. And I just say that if you are new, stick around long enough for the fog to lift. Just stick around long enough, and there are going to be days when you are not going to want to be here. There are going to want to be days when you're going to want to bolt out of the meeting. I just invite you to stick around. Because the gift comes with those of us who endure. Those of us who stick around, the resilient ones. The ones who don't drink no matter what. That's the only reason I got to be where I am today. I haven't had a drink. My sobriety date is July 26, 1979. And if God willing, a day at a time, thank you. If God willing, a day at a time, next month when I turn 26, I will be sober half of my life. I will be sober. Can you imagine? I am 52 years old. I will be sober half of my life. Just saying that blows me away. Half of my life. And it's because I just kept showing up and I didn't die. So, as far back as I can remember, I have hated who I was. As far back as I can remember, I hated being black. I hated being a girl. I hated being a southerner. I was born in Atlanta, Georgia in 1953. Yeah, one person from Atlanta? Okay. Two people. I hated all of that, and especially I hated being poor. I hated being who I was as a kid. And you know what? I remember when we moved from Atlanta to New York in 1959 when I was 6 years old, the kids used to make such horrible fun of me. I mean, unless you've been through that kind of torture, you just can't imagine what it feels like to be made fun of as a child because of being poor, because your hair is nappy, your clothes are poor, or because you're overweight or whatever it is. If you've been through that, you know the feelings. And the kids tore me apart. They made me feel like nothing. And you see, at that stage of my life, I didn't have Alcoholics Anonymous that said to me, you don't have to take that. See, I didn't have a program for living that said, you don't have to own what somebody else says about you. You know, you're not ugly because somebody else says you're ugly. You're not stupid because somebody else says you're stupid. You're not a lowlife because somebody else says you're a lowlife. See, at that stage of my life, I didn't know that. I didn't know I didn't have to buy into it. And so I believed everything negative that people told me about me. I believed I was the worst piece of anything on the face of the earth. And as a kid, I just, you know, feeling those feelings, I always felt different. I always felt sort of like a round peg in a square hole. I never fit. And I have to tell you, if anybody was paying attention to me as a little kid, if anybody was really looking at me, they knew that at some stage in my life, I was going to find a way out of that pain, because it was the kind of pain that just gnawed deep down in your gut that made you feel so different from everyone else. I have to tell you, my earliest escape in life came long before drugs and alcohol. My earliest escape in life from that pain of living in my own skin came from books and movies. I'm an old movie buff, and I'm a reader because my mother was a librarian. And I remember my mom would bring all kinds of books home from the library, and she'd have them in every room. On every wall, there were like reams and reams and reams of books. And sometimes I'd take a book off the shelf, and I'd sit in a corner all by myself, and I'd just open up the book and start reading. It's not for any particular reason. Somehow I felt safe in that book. And I think my mother used to think I was trying to become a smart kid. But what was really happening is when I opened up the book, between those binders was magic. Between those binders, there was an opportunity for me to not feel who I was. And it was awesome. It was so cool. I mean, I just got locked into the books. It was great. And it was the same thing with old movies. I'm an old movie buff. Anybody else like old movies? And now, you know, they've got all these different stations, you know, lots of distractions. But when I was growing up, there were only three channels on television, and old movies were on every channel. And I loved them. I mean, my favorite characters, they were characters. The women I loved the most were Betty Davis and Joan Crawford and Barbara Stanwyck and Susan Hayward. They were women who had a glass in one hand, they had a cigarette in the other, and they didn't take a whole lot of garbage from anybody. You know, and here I am, this little kid with this huge hole in my gut. I just wanted to fit in. And you know what? When I watched those girls in the movies, I started to fit in. I felt, okay, I can be like that. And that's how those are my earliest role models. I have to tell you, I learned a lot from them. I learned how to smoke cigarettes, which I haven't had a cigarette now in about 23 years, something like that, 22 and a half. That's pretty amazing. A gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because you know what? When I stopped drinking, I learned that my body was important. And if I wasn't taking care of it, I couldn't expect you to take care of it. But I learned how to smoke by watching Betty Davis. Anybody remember that movie, All About Eve? Where she's having that big party and she's got that long staircase with that long, sexy cigarette holder. And she's walking up talking about it's going to be a bumpy ride. I thought that she only known how bumpy the ride was to become. I used to stand in front of the mirror, and I bet you there are a couple of you like that. I stand in front of the mirror and puff and choke, right? Puff and choke. I learned how to be a smoker, just like I learned how to be a drinker. Because when you really want to do something, you learn how to do it. And I learned that from watching those women. I also learned how to do a lot of other things that later were to create havoc in my life. I learned from Susan Hayward how to sleep with other people's husbands. You know? And I stand up here today as a woman who no longer behaves that way, and I stand up here today as a woman who's no longer ashamed of my past. Why? Because I don't behave that way. Yeah. But I used to do it a lot. And I remember in the movie Backstreet, I learned how to do it from her. You know, she was with somebody else's husband. She found it necessary to be with somebody else's man. And everything I watched on TV was the same way. Soap operas, that's the message I got, and that's the message I wanted to get. And so I had some really unhealthy role models as a young girl. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous many years later, I had to be retaught how to do a lot of things because I had some very bad, bad behaviors. The books and the movies worked until they simply stopped working. And they worked for a long time. I have to tell you, for a long time, I used to get caught up in the books and the movies, and they would take me away to a different place, the place that was sweeter than the place where I lived, until they just stopped working. And it was around the age of 14 when instead of taking me away quicker and swifter, the books and the movies really made it more painful for me, actually made me more painfully aware that this was my life and it wasn't going to be much better. See, for a while, the books and movies took me to a different place, and then at the end, it made it perfectly clear that this was the hand I was dealt, whether I liked it or not. I can't stand up here and tell you that I then raced right out and decided to use drugs and alcohol. But I can tell you that there was something set in motion at that moment where I knew that I needed to find something that was stronger to take the pain away. And it was easy for me because I grew up in the 60s. I'm a product of the 60s growing up in New York City where it was all about better living through chemistry. So I knew what that was about. I knew what it was about to use something outside of me to take the pain away. And so from the age of 14 years old until the age of 26, when I literally crawled in here on my belly, I crawled into Alcoholics Anonymous on my belly. For those 12 years, I did not draw a sober breath. There was not one day that went by that I didn't use something to take the edge off, just a little bit, just a little bit. And you know what? A little bit ended up being a little bit more. And then I needed to take the edge off just a little bit more to take the edge off of what I had done before. And it's a vicious cycle, but before I knew it, I was caught in this sick spiral where I couldn't stop drinking and I couldn't stop using. I couldn't stop. Alcoholism took me to places that I would have never, ever, ever gone had I not been drunk. I would have never done some of the things that I did. And I can tell you now, I would have never done some of the things, and I would have never allowed other people to do some of the things that I allowed people to do to me because I was a drunk woman. Do you know, sometimes I think, had I had a crystal ball and had I been able to look down the road at where my life was to go when I was 14, 15 years old, had I been able to really look down the road and see where I was headed, I need to tell you, just for me, I would not have picked up the first drink. That's just for me. Had I known where I was going to go as a woman alcoholic for the next few years of my life, instead what I would have done, unfortunately, which is what a lot of young people choose to do today, I would have had the courage to cut the lights out. You see, I would have never opted for what I had to tolerate as a practicing alcoholic. I would have never stepped into the lion's den and said, yes, take me. I would have just taken me, because that would have been the easier, softer way. But you see, as any of us that are here a long time, know that nothing happens in God's universe by mistake. And I believe that the reason I didn't take my life years ago is because of the one person who is in this room this afternoon who came today without even knowing it necessarily, to hear my story only in the way that I could share it. You see, I think each of us has a message for someone, and my message is not for everyone here. No, make no mistake about it. I know that. My story is not for everybody here. But I believe that there's one person in here who is here by divine appointment, because they needed to see in the flesh how you get from point A to point C through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. See, that one person is why I didn't take my life. And I don't know who it is. I probably will find out at the end of the meeting. But that's why I didn't take my life. But boy, the journey from there to here has been hell. And that was my experience. I became the kind of woman, again, that I sold my soul. 14 years old, I was strung out on heroin. By the time I was 21 years old, I was selling my body to support my drug addiction and my alcoholism, because that's all I knew how to do as a woman. And I have to tell you, it's the fact that I can even stand up before 5,000-6,000 people today and share that is a gift of God, because there were years and years and years in this program when I couldn't. I remember when I first got sober, actually I told everybody. And then that stopped quickly at about 30 days when I realized what I was saying. And I realized how many people I was attracting that I didn't want to attract. Actually, that was thanks to my sponsor. And then for years I clammed up. For years I was so ashamed to admit who I had been. And I get to tell you today, I stand before you as a woman who walks with dignity. I get to stand before you today letting you know that I no longer live the way I used to live. And that's probably why it's easier for me to talk about it. It's been a long time since I sold my body. It's been a long time since I've allowed a man to put his hands on me when he's ready to beat up on me. It's been a long time since I've allowed anybody to put a knife to my throat or a gun to my head. been a long, long time since I slept with the devil. It's been a long time. In 1978, I was first introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I really wasn't ready to get sober. I was only 25 years old, and I believed I was way too hip, way too cute, and just wasn't ready to be here with you guys. And I was hanging out in New York at Studio 54, and it was like I was really hip. So I thought, really hip. And so I continued to drink and drink and drink. But you know, the interesting thing is, in 1979, I was first introduced to you. And the woman who tried her best, you know, God bless June, she tried her best to be what a sponsor would be, but how can you really sponsor somebody who's drinking? I mean, it's hard. But I remember she used to sit me down and she used to read from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she used to read that section that talks about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And you know what? When she used to read that to me, she never, ever stopped to explain what it meant. You know why? Because she knew I got it. See, when she heard my story, she knew I knew what it was like as a woman alcoholic, how to feel pitifully and incomprehensibly demoralized. She knew that from where I had come from, I knew exactly what it felt like to sell my body, to sell my soul to the highest bidder. She knew I knew what it was like to sometimes stand in the shower, and this is what I do. You know, sometimes I would come home from doing whatever it was I was doing out in the streets of New York, and I would stand under the shower and the water would beat down on me, and I would scrub my body trying to get the dirt off. And I know some of you know the dirt I'm talking about. I know you know that kind that you scrub and, you know, and sometimes I used to get abrasions on my skin because I'd be scrubbing so hard trying to get that dirt off, and it would never go away. And you know why it didn't go away? Because the dirt I was trying to take off my skin was the kind that was attached to the inside. It wasn't on the outside. See, I used to think soap and water would get rid of it. I used to think pretty clothes would get rid of it. I used to think if I had all that nice fragrant perfume. I even used to think if I was attached to him, then you couldn't smell me. But the truth is, that stench always came through because the dirt that was on my body was the kind that was deeply embedded on the inside. And the only thing that eventually got rid of that for me was Alcoholics Anonymous and working the 12 steps. I came into this program for real in 1979, and I came in here not by choice. I'm not one of those people that just kind of skipped in here and thought, okay, I'm here, I'm ready. And I'm grateful for the people who can come in that way, because I think it's important that we know that it's possible. I just wasn't one of them. My last drink was, the last thing I remember was I was sitting in a discotheque in Las Vegas, Nevada. Anybody from Vegas here? No. No. Not one. Yes? I was sitting in a disco in Las Vegas, Nevada, and the next thing I remember was I came to a hospital, Desert Springs Hospital, with my entire body in traction, and my left leg was in a cast. And I didn't have a clue how I got there. And what the doctors had told me and the cops who had found me in the street, they didn't think I was going to live, because when they found me in the street on Paradise Road, which was in a direction opposite from my house, they found my limp body with my left leg. It had come up behind my head, and the bone came straight through. Today I have my left leg is an inch shorter than my right leg, and I have a 10-inch scar with a lot of hole marks that I have chosen not to get rid of. Over the years, people have asked me, would I ever consider cosmetic surgery because the scar is so unattractive? And I can tell you just for today, I choose not to cover it up. Because you see, every time I look at my leg, I'm reminded of every drink I took, of every drug I took, and of every inappropriate act as a woman I performed. That car accident, being hit by that car, was the single most important thing that has ever happened to me in my life. I often say today that God broke my leg in order to save my life. And that's actually what happened. When I came to in that hospital that day, it was the beginning of the end of a life that I had known. It was the end of a life I had known and the beginning of a new life. I'd like to tell you that at that moment I stopped drinking, though. I'd really love to tell you that I just stopped drinking. And for those of you that are real alcoholics in here, you know that no mere car accident is going to stop you if you are on a mission. And I was on a mission. And so I didn't stop drinking. Took another month and a half. And then what I like to call that moment of clarity, I got a wake-up call. I had already been introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous the year before in New York, so I knew where to go. I had saved that big book that I had never opened when I first came in. I knew where to go. I have not had a drink or a drug since then, and that was July of 79. You know, I'd love to say to you that when I came in here, that I embraced Alcoholics Anonymous with open arms. I'd love to tell you that I ran right in here and I was so excited to be sober that I just did all the right stuff. Maybe like some of you. You came in and you were like little perfect AAs. I was not. I came in with a really bad attitude. And I'm not proud of this, by the way. It just is what it is. I came in with a really bad attitude. Actually, I used to sit on the side of the room. Actually, it was in the back. And I used to take up three seats. Now, who needs three seats in an AA meeting? I don't know. But I took up three seats. One for my bottom, one for my broken leg, and one for my crutches. Who puts crutches on a chair? But I'd sit in the back of the room with my arms crossed, daring you to make my day. I mean, I just had such an attitude. And I want you to know, there were plenty of people back there with me in what I like to endearingly call the inventory section. Oh, some of you know about that? How many of you know about the inventory section? Oh, yeah. Oh, a few of you. Some of you probably just won't admit it. But I used to sit back there, and that's exactly what I did. I used to take inventory all the time. I have to tell you, I didn't like men, and I didn't like women, and that doesn't leave a whole lot of people in between. You know, I didn't like anybody when I got sober. I just hated everybody. But even though I really despised men, I really, really hated women. I really, really hated women. And you know why? Because I hated myself as a woman. That's the only reason. And I've come to understand that in the years I'm sober. Thank God for the women who were healthy in this program, who just kept showing up and being the example. Because eventually, yes. Yeah. See, they knew my number. They had my number, but, I mean, they knew me immediately. They saw me coming. Coming in with, like, I'll tell you how I came in. Coming in looking like I looked. God bless the women in this program. And in particular, I wanted to say, it was at 30 days that I met the woman who was to become the single most important woman in my life. Her name was Louise Robertson. She's a former delegate, and she's now dead. She's passed on, and it's been about 3 years ago that she died. And Louise was the single most important person in my life for reasons that you probably wouldn't necessarily think are the reasons. She was the first person who had the courage to tell me the truth about who I was. She was the first person who didn't care that I didn't like her. It was that simple. She didn't care that I didn't like her. She didn't care that I thought she was cool. She loved me enough to tell me the truth about how I was behaving. And I'd like to share with you three things in particular that I learned from this woman. And if there's something I say that will resonate with you, all the better. But please know that this is not saying what you need to do. This is just what I had to learn. The first thing that Louise, well, first overall, she was the first person who told me that self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. That self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. She said, you know what, if you act like a hooker, you will be treated like a hooker. If you dress like a whore, you will be treated like a whore. She said, Francine, if every other word out of your mouth is a four-letter word, then don't be surprised if that's the response you get back from people. That self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts, behaving in a way that really makes you like who you are. Three things she taught me. The first was, and I know most of you already know this, but I was a little slow because of my early movie background. She said to me, you know what, Francine, it is not an esteemable act that you should be sleeping with somebody else's husband. Period. And she said, neither is it an esteemable act that you should be sleeping with somebody else's boyfriend and justifying that it's not their husband. duh. I mean, it wasn't my fault. That was my favorite phrase, and it was true. It wasn't my fault. I used to say to her, well, Louise, what happens if I'm walking down the street and a guy gives me the eye, he's holding on to his girlfriend? She said, you turn your head. I said, what? I should turn my head? You don't look at him. You don't give them the eye. It was like that was a novel concept. My thinking is if he said hello, even if he's squeezing his girl, why shouldn't I smile back and be cute? It didn't work that way. Self-esteem comes from doing esteemable action. I can tell you today, there is not one single woman in this room or any room that would ever have to worry about me being in the same room with your man. That might not mean a lot to you guys, but it means a lot to me. It means a lot. Actually, I have enough to deal with my own husband today. I don't have time for anybody else's. So that was one of the first things she taught me. The second thing that Louise taught me in terms of behavior changes was that I needed to learn how to dress. Now, picture this. I swear this is the truth, too. You know what a sash looks like? You know how little a sash is? Maybe about 6 inches? I used to come into AA meetings with hot pants the size of a sash. It was so small, what I had on my body, my cheeks were hanging out all over the place, and I am not talking about my facial cheeks. And I would have these little tops that were so little, it's like I shouldn't have even had anything on because I really didn't. I mean, a few years ago, there was the big to-do about Jennifer Lopez at the Grammys with that piece of scarf that she wore. She had nothing over on me. I mean, today when I think about how I used to go in public in AA meetings, and I couldn't figure out why all the men wanted my number and none of the women wanted to talk to me. It's amazing what we think works. And I guess for a long time it did, until it didn't. Until it simply didn't. The third behavior change Louise taught me that she had the courage to call me on was my mouth. I had a filthy mouth. I came in here, every other word was a four-letter word. And again, I'm not suggesting that you shouldn't curse up a storm. But I'm saying for me, I came to realize that it was not an esteemable act that I should use such foul language to describe how I felt. And it didn't matter that everybody else was doing it. You know, it's an interesting thing. Louise helped me realize that every time I dressed inappropriately and every time I cursed, it was my cry for attention. And she helped me recognize that one day in a meeting when every time I cursed, people laughed. And I started to recognize that in other people when I stopped. When people curse, people laugh. And she helped me realize that, you know, for someone like me, it was better to have negative reinforcement rather than no reinforcement at all. And so just to get the attention was a good thing. I just wanted attention. I was so needy and so sick and so unhealthy. I just wanted the attention. Today I can tell you for myself I don't curse. I choose not to curse. I have chosen to use other words to describe how I felt. And what that did was force me to learn how to use a dictionary. You know, I remember when I first got sober, I didn't understand a lot of the words in the big book or the 12 and 12. I mean, who had ever heard of vicissitude or rapacious? I mean, I had never heard of those words. And Louise had me with a dictionary, and every time I came across a word I didn't understand, I wrote the meaning in my book. And I still have those same books today. But I learned how to use other words. And when I was hurt and angry, instead of using four-letter words, I learned how to tell someone I was hurt and angry using different language. For me, that's been a big step. Again, because for me, in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's been about learning how to take the black words off the white page in the blue book. It's been more about a behavior change than anything else because, you know, it's not hard to stop drinking after you stop drinking. The real deal is to learn how to stay stopped. And I have found for myself that the way I've stayed stopped is by changing my personality, changing my behavior. And the truth is Bill W. tells us that. For anybody who thinks this is not about behavior change, think again. On the very first page of As Bill Sees It, it says that for us to have any kind of sustained recovery, we have to change our behavior. And Louise helped me do that. I went kicking and screaming. But today, as I look back on where I've come from and where I am today, I'm grateful for this woman. And I'm grateful that she knew it for most of the time she was alive. I didn't like her in the beginning, but she became the most precious gift you have given me in my sobriety. My prayer is that everyone finds a sponsor, maybe not that tough, because I know in this day and age we kind of recoil from tough sponsors like we would a hot flame. I think it was the best thing for me, because I'm one of those people that you give me an inch, I would take a mile. And so I needed someone who had the courage to call me on my stuff. What she also helped me realize around that time when I was relatively new, about 2 years, I used to talk about how I was very jealous of other people. I was particularly jealous of people who had things that I didn't, who had careers, who had nice homes, who had anything that I didn't have, because even though I had made a lot of money in my drinking years because I was kept, by the time I got sober, I had nothing. Literally everything had been taken from me due to my addiction. And so instead of being jealous, Louise said, well, why don't you go back to school? Instead of spending all that energy complaining about other people, why don't you go and change your own life? You know, the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous provides us with the tools to do that. And I used to sit around complaining, and she said, you know what, Francine, you can use all kinds of excuses not to do what you want to do in life. You can use the fact that you're black. You can use the fact that you're a woman for not having anything or not doing anything. And you can also use your history. You can use your past, your colorful past, as an excuse for doing nothing. Or you can get up off your tush and go do something different. And I was 2 years sober when I decided to go back to school, and this was a big thing for me. I was a high school dropout. And I particularly say that in case there are any people in here who have a dream. Maybe some of you in here deep down inside, and maybe you're even afraid to talk about it. You know, my sobriety is about dreaming. Let me just say that up front. The greatest gift I've been given next to Louise and next to just not drinking has been the ability to dream, to step outside of my comfort zone and dream big. And I was really, really scared when I decided I wanted to do this thing. You know, at 2 years I decided I wanted to go pursue a career that was going to take me to a different place, just in my mind, because the education alone was hard. But I did it. A day at a time, it took me 10 long years in this program. But my dream of becoming a lawyer came true in 1989. I graduated from... In 1989, I graduated from one of the top law schools in this country, Georgetown. And I can tell you, you don't get from the South Bronx in the gutter to where I get to be today, but for Alcoholics Anonymous. It's this program that's done it. And I want to just say for a moment, for those of you who think it was an easy journey, I said it took 10 years, so it wasn't an easy journey. It took long, hard struggling through school when I couldn't read half the time. It took failing bar exams until I got it right. It took showing up when I did not want to show up. You see, people often ask me, how is it I've gotten to where I am today? And the single most important thing, aside from Alcoholics Anonymous overall, because when I'm in a public arena, I don't talk about Alcoholics Anonymous from the platform, because that's against our traditions. In one-on-one, I do. But the single most important thing is my willingness to show up when I didn't want to show up. That's how I stayed sober for almost 26 years. I showed up when I didn't want to show up. I got through school because I showed up when I didn't want to show up. And I have people all the time come to me and say, Francine, I want to do this, I want to do that. What does it take? It takes showing up. It takes doing those things that you don't want to do. But if you really want the goal, if you really want the end result, whether it's not drinking, whether it's to lose weight, whether it's to go back to school, whatever it is, it takes showing up. That's what you taught me how to do. 10 long years it took me to show up. About 10 years ago, one of my other mentors, actually all three of my mentors are dead today, Hal Marley, Dr. Paul, some of you might have been privileged enough to hear Dr. Paul speak at some time during his life, and Louise. And Dr. Paul was one of the first people who said to me, you know what, Francine, the dreams don't have to stop with being a lawyer. The dreams don't have to stop here. He said, you know what, I think you should be writing books. He was the first person to tell me that because Dr. Paul had just himself written a couple of books. And he had, you know, already done the passage in the big book, Alcoholic, Dr. Alcoholic Addict. He said to me in 1993, Francine, you should be writing. And you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have been taught that I can have anything I want if I'm willing to do the work. Anything. But you know what gets in the way? And it got in the way for me. That thing called fear. Fear is really, really, really powerful. Fear is the thing that says to us, you don't really want to do something that you really want to do. Because it's easier to say I don't want to do it rather than say I'm scared. And I kept saying to Dr. Paul, you know, but I don't really think I should be writing. I don't really know how to write. You know, I'm a lawyer. I don't know how to write. And I bought into that because people kept telling me I couldn't write because I was a lawyer. It took years and years and years and years. Actually, it took 10 years. And then yet another dream came true. Because I don't drink and because I don't use drugs and because I show up for myself, not only did I get to live one experience of a dream that I never thought was possible, I got to see myself be a published author, have the first book come out of my brain that I created because I was sober. It's like, who would have thought? So my message primarily is if you are new, and even if you're not, sometimes it's scary to go for the dream. Because you know what? Sometimes we got lots of people around us telling us we can't. Who do you think you are? And you'll never amount to anything. I like to say it this way. I believe you can't go to hardware stores and get oranges. And I used to go to people who themselves were living in fear, expecting them to encourage me out of my fear. And they couldn't do it. How could they help me walk through my fears towards a dream when they couldn't help themselves? And so eventually I found people who were able to support me in moving toward that direction. Louise was the first person. Dr. Paul was another. Today I get to encourage other people in the same way. When I was newly sober, I was invited to make a list of all the things I wanted out of my sobriety. And on that list, as often we have heard, I would have shortchanged myself. On that list, I would have never, ever, ever included the things that have become most valuable to me in my recovery. On that list, you would have found things like fur coats and diamond rings and kitty cats and stereos. Because those are the things that were important to me before. That's all that was important. You would have never found the things that I value today, the things that are those intangibles that nobody can take away from me. Not anybody, unless I give it up. And I'm not willing to do that today. On that list today, what you'd find are things like my sobriety at the top of the list. You see, my sobriety is the greatest gift I have been given. And it's not even just that I say that. You know how you really know that my sobriety is important? How I act. I think the proof is in the pudding. I treat my sobriety like it's valuable. At 25 plus years of sobriety, I still go to meetings. At 25 years plus sobriety, I still take a meeting every single month into jail. I go to jail every month. Every month I get to leave. But I go to jail every month. Unless I'm out of town. Every month. You know what? Last year when I turned 25 years sober, I actually showed up. The fourth Monday of the month is when I go to the Marin County Jail. That was when my birthday was last year. And the girls kept saying to me, why are you here? I mean, after 25 years, I mean, why do you still come here to see us? And you know what? They didn't get it, but then they did. You know why? Some of you know why I keep going to jail. Some of you know why I keep showing up doing H&I at 25 years of sobriety. Because why would I stop doing the very thing that enables me to stand up here today? Why would I stop doing what enables me to live the life I live? I still do all those things. I still sponsor women. I still read my books. I still do all the things I did when I was new. That's how you know I love my sobriety. Not just because I say it because talk's cheap, but you can watch how I walk. What else you find on that list today is the gift of courage. I used to think that courage was an absence of fear. I used to think that you were courageous if you kept your chest out and you kind of, you know, beat up on people and you were the biggest and the baddest. Growing up in the South Bronx, that's what I believed. Today for me, courage is not an absence of fear. Today, courage is a willingness to walk through the fear. It's being afraid, having the courage to admit it, and you walk through it. That's courage today. Every time I show up on the platform, I'm scared. I know there are a lot of speakers who say they're not scared when they speak. I'm not one of them. Every time I get up to the platform, whether I'm talking to 5 or 5,000, it's a scary thing because I've got to open up my soul and tell you the truth. See, that's why it's scary for me, because I tell you the truth. Very scary. But you know what? I do it anyway. That's being courageous. Feel the fear and do it anyway. That's what I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's one of the gifts, those intangible gifts on my list. Another one of the gifts you'd find today is the gift of self-esteem. And self-esteem, the genuine kind, the kind that comes from doing esteemable acts. The kind that comes from walking through the fear, taking care of my health, taking care of my finances, making some better choices. What you'd also find on that list today is the gift of my mom. And I know in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's a tough topic to bring up. And I have to just say that I love my mother today. I love my mother. And at the same time, I'm grateful for the women when I first got sober who hated their moms and who didn't hesitate to talk about it. I'm grateful for all the women who talked about how they couldn't stand their mothers, because when I came in and couldn't stand my mother, had I heard somebody talk about how great their moms were, I would have felt like a leper. I would have felt, oh my God, I'm so different. But I heard enough women who I could connect with who did not like their mothers. But I have to also tell you, when the time came, I became more and more grateful for the women who became willing to take the black words off the white pages in the blue book and start using the 12 steps to change the relationship with their parents. For me, that was important because, again, talk's cheap. It's easy for me to stand up here and tell you I'm working a program, and yet I have horrible relationships with everybody in my family. It's not the way it is today. One of the hardest amends I had to make was to my mom. And thank God for that, because you know what? Today, if my mother would have dropped dead right at this very, very moment, I would feel sad, I would feel hurt, but there is no unfinished business between she and I. That I owe to Alcoholics Anonymous. On that list, you find my mom. What you'd also find on my list is the gift of God. I got sober, like a lot of us. I didn't believe in God. You know, I'm one of those people. I was an agnostic. I wasn't an atheist. I knew that there was something out there, but just not for me. Because growing up poor and growing up black and living the way I lived, there's no way in the world you could tell me there was a loving God. No way. So I didn't buy into that. But I knew there was something for some people. And over the years, I came to believe in a power greater than myself for me. And today I'm one of those people in the 12 and 12 in the 11th step where it talks about I would no more do without my faith than I would do without air, food, or sunshine. That's how delicious my experience is with God today. I believe that the only way I get to stand up here before you this afternoon is because there's a faith in my life. It doesn't have to be that way for everyone, but for this alcoholic, I get to stand up here living the life I live because of the grace of God in Alcoholics Anonymous. And finally, I'd like to tell you what you find on that list for me today is the gift of love. The gift of an open heart. And you know, it's easy to give that one lip service too. You know, it's easy to say I love everybody and yet not even want to talk to the person sitting next to me because they're a different color, different religion, maybe different sexual orientation. For me, I'd be really hard-pressed today to tell you that I'm working any kind of spiritual program and I hate anybody for those reasons. For me, I'd be really, really hard-pressed to stand up here and tell you that I'm really working a spiritual program and I hate somebody because they have a different political view than I do, or because their sexual orientation is different, or because their religious choices are different. I've been tested on that daily in this program. Tested. And I get to tell you that while I don't do it perfectly, today I get to live a life where my heart's a lot open than it used to be. And again, how do you know that? Not because of what I say, but what do you see in my life? The people in my life today is how you get to prove how I live my life. I sponsor women from all different races. I have friends that are from all parts of the globe. My husband is Jewish, and he's from the Bronx. And I can tell you the real diversity issue in our family is not that he's Jewish and from the Bronx, is that he's a therapist. So, I mean, just figure a lawyer and a therapist. That's kind of diverse. But my point is, you know, again, I'm a believer in walking like I talk, and I don't do it 100%, but you can look at my life and see that I believe what I say I believe. It's hard for me to tell you that I believe that we're all the same and I don't have any friends that look different from me. It's a little hard, but it's right in my family. It's really right up front and personal. I get to walk this path with other people. I get to really demonstrate that God is everywhere. If I really believe in God and not just giving it lip service, then that means God's in my home. That means God's in you, in you, in you, in you, and all of us that don't look the same. That's where God lives. That's where my God lives. I love what I've been given in almost 26 years of sobriety. 25 plus, okay. I love what I've been given. And it's not been an easy journey. But I just tell you, if you're newly sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and you think this deal doesn't work, just stick around long enough for the fog to lift. Amazing things come to pass when we are willing to show up. Amazing things. Today, as a woman, I get to like who I am. Again, not because I say so, but because of how I treat myself and what I don't let you do to me. You know, how I encourage other people to treat me. That's how you get to know that somebody really loves who they are. Is there room for improvement? Absolutely. Absolutely, I'm a work in progress. But from where I've come from to where I stand today, God's good. God's good because I don't drink, I don't use drugs, and I show up. In closing, I'd like to read something from conference-approved literature, just in case there are any AA purists in the room. I know there are a few of you. Well, I tell you, to be able to wear glasses in public, I started wearing reading glasses when I was like 49 years old, and it was the hardest thing for me to do. I had 20/15 vision all my life, and that's when I knew I was getting old. That was the moment, that and the weight. The weight was a little harder to come off. But the eyes, oh my God. So now, okay, so you see, it's so cool. And the freedom in this today is I get to be who I am and let you see who I am. So I always like to end my talks with this. And this is from As Bill Sees It. When I got sober, it was called AA Way of Life. But it's a wonderful, wonderful book if you're newly sober. It's a collection of pieces from all of our literature, including articles and letters from Bill W. And I always like to end with this particular passage on page 4 that's entitled, Can We Choose? We must never be blinded by the futile philosophy that we are just the hapless victims of our inheritance, of our life experience, and of our surroundings, that these are the sole forces that make our decisions for us. This is not the road to freedom. We have to believe that we can really choose. And you know what? That's what you've given me in 25 years of sobriety. You've given me the gift of choice. You've taught me that it doesn't matter where I've come from, doesn't matter what color my skin is, doesn't matter whether my one leg's shorter than the other, doesn't matter whether I believe in God or I do believe in God, doesn't matter where I live, it doesn't matter about any of that stuff. You've taught me that the only thing that matters in the overall scheme of things is what I do with this most precious gift I've been given. You know, I heard somebody say once that God's gift to me is my sobriety and my gift to God is what I do with it. That's what you've taught me, that it's what I do with this most precious gift. And it's not just what I do with it in AA meetings, because it's easy to be nice to people in AA meetings sometimes. But it's what do I do with this gift out there in traffic? It's what do I do when somebody cuts me off? It's what do I do with this gift on the line in the supermarket when people are moving a little too slow, in my opinion. Or the line in the bank. It's what do I do with this gift in my home? You know, it's one thing to stand up here and talk this great thing, but how do I treat my husband? Do I treat my husband like a dog and then come here and talk about AA? Nah. You've taught me that it's everywhere I go. And you've said to me over and over and over again that the only thing that you ask of me, the only thing that you ask of me in this gift that I've been given is that I always be willing to pass it on. And for that I will forever be grateful. Thank you so much for my sobriety, and thank you for being here.